I saw the first one, the first little one, in that movie theater in the week between Christmas and New Year's of 1975. He gave a brief, barking laugh. And now that I think back, that theater was called the Gaiety. Isn't that surprising? He paused, looking into their faces with some puzzlement. It's not. You're not surprised at all.
Coincidence has been canceled, honey, Susanna said. What we're living in these days is more like the Charles Dickens version of reality.
I don't understand you.
You don't need to, Shug. Go on, tell your tale.
The old fellow took a moment to find the dropped thread, then went on. I saw my first Type 3 in late December of 1975. By that night, about 3 months later, when I saw the blue glow around Lupe's neck, I'd come across half a dozen more. Only one of them, at Prey, he was down in an East Village alley with another guy. He, the vampire, was standing like this.
Callahan rose and demonstrated, arms out, palms propped against an invisible wall.
The other one, the victim, was between his propped arms, facing him. They could have been talking, they could have been kissing, but I knew that it wasn't either one. The others, I saw a couple in restaurants, both of them eating alone. That glow was all over their hands and their faces, smeared across their lips like electric blueberry juice. And the burned onion smell hung around them like some kind of perfume.
Callahan smiled briefly.
It strikes me how every description I try to make has some kind of simile buried in it. Because I'm not just trying to describe them, you know, I'm trying to understand them. Still trying to understand them. To figure out how there could have been this other world, this secret world, there all the time, right beside the one I'd always known.
Roland's right, Eddie thought. It's Todash. Gotta be. He doesn't know it, but it is. Does that make him one of us? Part of our quartet?
I saw one in line at Marine Midland Bank, where Home did its business, Callahan said. Middle of the day, I was in the deposit line. This woman was in withdrawals. That light was all around her. She saw me looking at her and smiled. Fearless eye contact. Flirty. He paused. Sexy.
You knew them because of the vampire demon's blood in you, Roland said. Did they know you?
No, Callahan said promptly. If they'd been able to see me, to isolate me, my life wouldn't have been worth a dime. Although they came to know about me, that was later, though. My point is, I saw them. I knew they were there. And when I saw what had happened to Lupe, I knew what had been at him. They see it, too. Smell it. Probably hear the chimes as well. Their victims are marked, and after that, more are apt to come, like bugs to a light, or dogs, all determined to piss on the same telephone pole. I'm sure that night in March was the first time Lupe was bitten, because I never saw that glow around him before. Or the marks on the side of his throat, which looked like no more than a couple of shaving nicks. But he was bitten repeatedly after that. It had something to do with the nature of the business we were in, working with transients. Maybe drinking alcohol-laced blood is a cheap high for them, who knows? In any case, it was because of Lupe that I made my first kill. The first of many. This was in April.
10. This is April, and the air has finally begun to feel and smell like spring. Callahan has been at home since 5, first writing checks to cover end-of-the-month bills, then working on his culinary specialty, which he calls toads and dumplings stew. The meat is actually stewing beef, but the colorful name amuses him. He's been washing the big steel pot as he goes along, not because he needs to. One of the few things there's no shortage of at home is cooking gear, but because that's the way his mother taught him to operate in the kitchen. Clean as you go. He takes a pot to the back door, holds it against his hip with one hand, turns the knob with his other hand. He goes out into the alley, meaning to toss the soapy water into the sewer grating out there, and then he stops. Here is something he has seen before, down in the village, but then the two men, the one standing against the wall, the one in front of him, leaning forward with his hands propped against the bricks, were only shadows. These two he can see clearly in the light from the kitchen. And the one leaning back against the wall, seemingly asleep, with his head turned to the side, exposing his neck, is someone Callahan knows. It is Lupe. Although the open door has lit up this part of the alley, and Callahan has made no effort to be quiet, has, in fact, been singing Lou Reed's Take a Walk on the Wild Side, neither of them notices him. They are entranced. The man in front of Lupe looks to be about 50, well-dressed in a suit and a tie. Beside him, an expensive Mark Cross briefcase rests on the cobbles. This man's head is thrust forward and tilted. His open lips are sealed against the right side of Lupe's neck. What's under there, jugular? Carotid? Callahan doesn't remember, nor does it matter. The chimes don't play this time, but the smell is overwhelming, so rank that tears burst from his eyes and clear mucus immediately begins to drip from his nostrils. The two men opposite him blaze with that dark blue light, and Callahan can see it swirling in rhythmic pulses. That's their breathing, he thinks. It's their breathing, stirring that shit around. Which means it's real. Callahan can hear, very faintly, a liquid smooching sound. It's the sound you hear in a movie when a couple is kissing passionately, really pouring it on. He doesn't think about what he does next. He puts down the potful of sudsy, greasy water. It clanks loudly on the concrete stoop, but the couple leaning against the alley wall opposite don't stir. They remain lost in their dream. Callahan takes two steps backward into the kitchen. On the counter is the cleaver he's been using to cube the stew beef. Its blade gleams brightly. He can see his face in it and thinks, well, at least I'm not one. My reflection's still there. Then he closes his hand around the rubber grip. He walks back out into the alley. He steps over the pot of soapy water. The air is mild and damp. Somewhere water is dripping. Somewhere a radio is blaring, "Someone Saved My Life Tonight." Moisture in the air makes a halo around the light on the far side of the alley. It's April in New York, and 10 feet from where Callahan, not long ago an ordained priest of the Catholic Church, stands, a vampire is taking blood from his prey, from the man with whom Donald Callahan has fallen in love. "Almost had your hooks in me, didn't you, dear?" Elton John sings, and Callahan steps forward, raising the cleaver. He brings it down, and it sinks deep into the vampire's skull. The sides of the vampire's face push out like wings. He raises his head suddenly, like a predator that has just heard the approach of something bigger and more dangerous than he is. A moment later, he dips slightly at the knees as if meaning to pick up the briefcase, then seems to decide he can do without it. He turns and walks slowly toward the mouth of the alley, toward the sound of Elton John, who is now singing, "Someone saved, someone saved, someone saved my life tonight." The cleaver is still sticking out of the thing's skull. The handle waggles back and forth with each step like a stiff little tail. Callahan sees some blood, but not the ocean he would have expected. At that moment, he is too deep in shock to wonder about this, but later he will come to believe that there is precious little liquid blood in these beings. Whatever keeps them moving, it's more magical than the miracle of blood. Most of what was their blood has coagulated as firmly as the yolk of a hard-cooked egg. It takes another step, then stops. Its shoulders slump. Callahan loses sight of its head when it sags forward, and then, suddenly, the clothes are collapsing, crumpling in on themselves, drifting down to the wet surface of the alley. Feeling like a man in a dream, Callahan goes forward to examine them. Lupe Delgado stands against the wall, head back, eyes shut, still lost in whatever dream the vampire has cast over him. Blood trickles down his neck in small and unimportant streams. Callahan looks at the clothes. The tie is still knotted, the shirt is still inside the suit coat. and still tucked into the suit pants. He knows that if he unzipped the fly of those suit pants, he would see the underwear inside. He picks up one arm of the coat, mostly to confirm its emptiness by touch as well as sight, and the vampire's watch tumbles out of the sleeve and lands with a clink beside what looks like a class ring. There's hair. There are teeth, some with fillings. Of the rest of Mr. Mark Cross' briefcase, there is no sign. Callahan gathers up the clothes. Elton John is still singing "Someone Saved My Life Tonight," but maybe that's not surprising. It's a pretty long song, one of those four-minute jobs, must be. He puts the watch on his own wrist and the ring on one of his own fingers, just for temporary safekeeping. He takes the clothes inside, walking past Lupe, Lupe still lost in his dream. And the holes in his neck, little bigger than pinpricks to start with, are disappearing. The kitchen is miraculously empty. Off it, to the left, is a door marked storage. Beyond it is a short hall with compartments on both sides. These are behind locked gates made of heavy chicken wire to discourage pilferage. Canned goods on one side, dry goods on the other. Then clothes. Shirts in one compartment, pants in another. Dresses and skirts in another, coats in yet another. At the very end of the hall is a beat-up wardrobe marked miscellany. Callahan finds the vampire's wallet and sticks it in his pocket on top of his own. The two of them together make quite a lump. Then he unlocks the wardrobe and tosses in the vampire's unsorted clothes. It's easier than trying to take his ensemble apart, although he guesses that when the underwear is found inside the pants, there will be grumbling. At home, used underwear is not accepted. "We may cater to the low-bottom crowd," Rowan Magruder has told Callahan once, "but we do have our standards." Never mind their standards now. There's the vampire's hair and teeth to think about. His watch, his ring, his wallet, and God, his briefcase and his shoes, they must still be out there. "Don't you dare complain," he tells himself, "not when 95% of him is gone, just conveniently disappeared, like the monster in the last reel of a horror movie. God's been with you so far, I think it's God, so don't you dare complain." Nor does he. He gathers up the hair, the teeth, the briefcase, and takes them to the end of the alley, splashing through puddles and tosses them over the fence. After a moment's consideration, he throws the watch, wallet, and ring over too. The ring sticks on his finger for a moment, and he almost panics, but at last it comes off, and over it goes, plink. Someone will take care of this stuff for him. This is New York, after all. He goes back to Lupe and sees the shoes. They're too good to throw away, he thinks. There are years of wear left in those babies. He picks them up and walks back into the kitchen with them dangling from the first two fingers of his right hand. He's standing there with them by the stove when Lupe comes walking into the kitchen from the alley. "Don?" he asks. His voice is a little furry, the voice of someone who has just awakened from a sound sleep. It also sounds amused. He points at the shoes hooked over the tips of Callahan's fingers. "Were you going to put those in the stew?" "It might improve the flavor, but no, just in storage," Callahan says. He is astounded by the calmness of his own voice. And his heart, beating along at a nice regular 60 or 70 beats a minute. "Someone left them out back. What have you been up to?" Lupe gives him a smile, and when he smiles, he is more beautiful than ever. "Just out there having a smoke," he says. "It was too nice to come in. Didn't you see me?" "As a matter of fact, I did," Callahan said. "You looked lost in your own little world, and I didn't want to interrupt you. Open the storage room door for me, would you?" Lupe opens the door. "That looks like a really nice pair," he says. "Bally. What's someone doing leaving Bally shoes for the drunks?" "Someone must have changed his mind about them," Callahan says. He hears the bells, that poison sweetness, and grits his teeth against the sound. The world seems to shimmer for a moment. "Not now," he thinks. "Ah, not now, please." It's not a prayer. He prays little these days, but maybe something hears because the sound of the chimes fades. The world steadies. From the other room, someone is bawling for supper. Someone else is cursing. Same old, same old. And he wants a drink. That's the same, too, only the craving is fiercer than it's ever been. He keeps thinking about how the rubber grip felt in his hand, the weight of the cleaver, the sound it made. And the taste is back in his mouth, the dead taste of Barlow's blood, that too. What did the vampire say in the Petrie's kitchen after it had broken the crucifix his mother had given him? That it was sad to see a man's faith fail. I'll sit in on the AA meeting tonight, he thinks, putting a rubber band around the bally loafers and tossing them in with the rest of the footwear. Sometimes the meetings help. He never says, I'm Don and I'm an alcoholic, but sometimes they help. Lupe is so close behind him when he turns around that he gasps a little. Easy, boy, Lupe says, laughing. He scratches his throat casually. The marks are still there, but they'll be gone in the morning. Still, Callahan knows the vampires see something, or smell it, or some damn thing. Listen, he says to Lupe, I've been thinking about getting out of the city for a week or two. A little R&R. Why don't we go together? We could go upstate, do some fishing. Can't, Lupe says. I don't have any vacation time coming at the hotel until June. And besides, we're short-handed here, but if you want to go, I'll square it with Rowan. No problem. Lupe looks at him closely. You could use some time off, looks like. You look tired. And you're jumpy. Nah, it was just an idea, Callahan says. He's not going anywhere. If he stays, maybe he can watch out for Lupe. And he knows something now. Killing them is no harder than swatting bugs on a wall, and they don't leave much behind. Easy cleanup, as they say in the TV ads. Lupe will be all right. The Type 3s, like Mr. Mark Cross' briefcase, don't seem to kill their prey or even change them. At least, not that he can see, not over the short term. But he will watch. He can do that much. He will mount a guard. It'll be one small act of atonement for Jerusalem's lot. And Lupe will be all right. 11. Except he wasn't, Roland said. He was carefully rolling a cigarette from the crumbs at the bottom of his poke. The paper was brittle, the tobacco really not much more than dust.
No, Callahan agreed. He wasn't. Roland, I have no cigarette papers, but I can do you better for a smoke than that. There's good tobacco in the house from down south. I don't use it, but Rosalita sometimes likes a pipe in the evening.
I'll take you up on that later and say thank you, the gunslinger said. I don't miss it as much as coffee, but almost. Finish your tale. Leave nothing out. I think it's important we hear it all, but...
I know. Time is short.
Yes, Roland said. Time is short.
Then, briefly put, my friend contracted this disease. AIDS became the name of choice.
He was looking at Eddie, who nodded.
All right, Callahan said. It's as good a name as any, I guess, although the first thing I think of when I hear that word is a kind of diet candy. You may know it doesn't always spread fast, but in my friend's case, it moved like a fire in straw. By mid-May of 1976, Lupe Delgado was very ill. He lost his color, he was feverish a lot of the time. He'd sometimes spend the whole night in the bathroom vomiting. Rowan would have banned him from the kitchen, but he didn't need to. Lupe banned himself, and then the blemishes began to show up. They called those Kaposi sarcoma, I think, Eddie said. A skin disease. Disfiguring. Callahan nodded. 3 weeks after the blemishes started showing up, Lupe was a New York general. Rowan Magruder and I went to see him one night in late June. Up until then, we'd been telling each other he'd turn it around, come out of it better than ever. Hell, he was young and strong. But that night, we knew the minute we were in the door that he was all through. He was in an oxygen tent. There were IV lines running into his arms. He was in terrible pain. He didn't want us to get close to him. It might be catching, he said. In truth, no one seemed to know much about it.
Which made it scarier than ever, Susanna said.
Yes. He said the doctors believed it was a blood disease spread by homosexual activity, or maybe by sharing needles. And what he wanted us to know, what he kept saying over and over again, was that he was clean. All the drug tests came back negative. Not since 1970, he kept saying. Not one toke off one joint, I swear to God. We said we knew he was clean. We sat on either side of his bed and he took our hands.
Callahan swallowed. There was an audible click in his throat.
Our hands. He made us wash them before we left. Just in case, he said. And he thanked us for coming. He told Rowan that home was the best thing that ever happened to him. That as far as he was concerned, it really was home. I never wanted a drink as badly as I did that night, leaving New York General. I kept Rowan right beside me, though, and the two of us walked past all the bars. That night I went to bed sober, but I lay there knowing it was really just a matter of time. The first drink is the one that gets you drunk, that's what they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, and mine was somewhere close. Somewhere, a bartender was just waiting for me to come in so he could pour it out. Two nights later, Lupe died. There must have been 300 people at the funeral, almost all of them people who'd spent time in home. There was a lot of crying and a lot of wonderful things said, some by folks who probably couldn't have walked a chalk line. When it was over, Rowan Magruder took me by the arm and said, I don't know who you are, Don, but I know what you are. One hell of a good man, and one hell of a bad drunk who's been dry for how long has it been? I thought about going on with the bullshit, but it just seemed like too much work. Since October of last year, I said. You want one now, he said. That's all over your face. So I tell you what, if you think taking a drink will bring Lupe back, you have my permission. In fact, come get me and we'll go down to the Blarney Stone together and drink up what's in my wallet first, okay? Okay, I said. He said, you getting drunk today would be the worst memorial to Lupe I could think of. Like pissing in his dead face. He was right, and I knew it. I spent the rest of that day the way I spent my second one in New York, walking around, fighting that taste in my mouth, fighting the urge to score a bottle and stake out a park bench. I remember being on Broadway, then over on 10th Avenue, then way down at Park and 30th. By then it was getting dark, cars going both ways on Park with their lights on, the sky all orange and pink in the west, and the streets full of this gorgeous long light. A sense of peace came over me, and I thought, I'm going to win. Tonight, at least, I'm going to win. And that was when the chimes started, the loudest ever. I felt as if my head would burst. Park Avenue shimmered in front of me, and I thought, why, it's not real at all. Not Park Avenue, not any of it. It's just a gigantic swatch of canvas. New York is nothing but a backdrop painted on that canvas, and what's behind it? Why, nothing. Nothing at all. Just blackness. Then things steadied again. The chimes faded, faded, finally gone. I started to walk very slowly, like a man walking on thin ice. What I was afraid of was that if I stepped too heavily, I might plunge right out of the world and into the darkness behind it. I know that makes absolutely no sense. Hell, I knew it then. But knowing a thing doesn't always help, does it? No, Eddie said, thinking of his days snorting heroin with Henry.
No, said Susanna.
No, Roland agreed, thinking of Jericho Hill, thinking of the fallen horn. I walked one block, then two, then three. I started to think it was going to be okay. I mean, I might get the bad smell, and I might see a few type threes, but I could handle those things, especially since the type threes didn't seem to recognize me. Looking at them was like looking through one-way glass at suspects in a police interrogation room. But that night I saw something much, much worse than a bunch of vampires.
You saw someone who was actually dead, Susanna said.
Callahan turned to her with a look of utter, flabbergasted surprise.
How? How do you—
I know, because I've been Todash in New York, too, Susanna said. We all have. Roland says those are people who either don't know they've passed on or refuse to accept it. They're— what do you call them, Roland?
The vagrant dead, the gunslinger replied. There aren't many. There were enough,
Callahan said, and they knew I was there, mangled people on Park Avenue, one of them a man without eyes, one a woman missing the arm and leg on the right side of her body, and burned all over, both of them looking at me as if they thought I could fix them somehow. I ran, and I must have run one hell of a long way, because when I came back to something like sanity, I was sitting on the curb at 2nd Avenue and 19th Street, head hung down, panting like a steam engine. Some old geezer came along and asked if I was all right. By then I'd caught enough of my breath to tell him that I was. He said that in that case I'd better move along because there was an NYPD radio car just a couple of blocks away and it was coming in our direction. They'd roust me for sure, maybe bust me. I looked the old guy in the eyes and said, I've seen vampires, killed one even, and I've seen The Walking Dead. Do you think I'm afraid of a couple of cops in a radio car? He backed off, said to keep away from him, said I'd looked okay, so he tried to do me a favor. Said this was what he got. In New York, no good deed goes unpunished, he said, and stomped off down the street like a kid having a tantrum. I started laughing. I got up off the curb and looked down at myself. My shirt was untucked all the way around. I had crud on my pants from running into something. I couldn't even remember what. I looked around, and there by all the saints and all the sinners was the Americano Bar. I found out later there are several of them in New York, but I thought then that one had moved down from the 40s just for me. I went inside, took the stool at the end of the bar, and when the bartender came down, I said, "You've been keeping something for me." "Is that so, my pal?" he said. "Yes," I said. "Well," he said, "you tell me what it is and I'll get it for you." "It's Bushmills. And since you've had it since last October, why don't you add the interest and make it a double?" Eddie winced. "Bad idea, man." Right then, it seemed like the finest idea ever conceived by the mind of mortal man. I'd forget Lupe, stop seeing dead people, perhaps even stop seeing the vampires. The mosquitoes, as I came to think of them. By 8 o'clock, I was drunk. By 9, I was very drunk. By 10, I was as drunk as I'd ever been. I have a vague memory of the barman throwing me out. A slightly better one of waking up the next morning in the park under a blanket of newspapers. "Back to the beginning," Susanna murmured. "Aye, lady, back to the beginning. You say true. I say thank you." I sat up. I thought my head was going to split wide open. I put it down between my knees, and when it didn't explode, I raised it again. There was an old woman sitting on a bench about 20 yards away from me, just an old lady with a kerchief on her head, feeding the squirrels from a paper bag filled with nuts. Only that blue light was crawling all over her cheeks and brow, going into and out of her mouth when she breathed. She was one of them, a mosquito. The Walking Dead were gone, but I could still see the type threes. Getting drunk again seemed like a logical response to this, but I had one small problem. No money. Someone had apparently rolled me while I was sleeping it off under my newspaper blanket. And there goes your ball game. Callahan smiled. There was nothing pleasant about it. That day I did find manpower. I found it the next day, too, and the day after that. Then I got drunk. That became my habit during the summer of the tall ships. Work 3 days sober, usually shoving a wheelbarrow on some construction site or lugging big boxes for some company moving floors, then spend one night getting enormously drunk and the next day recovering. Then start all over again. Take Sundays off. That was my life in New York that summer. And everywhere I went, it seemed that I heard that Elton John song, "Someone Saved My Life Tonight." I don't know if that was the summer it was popular or not. I only know I heard it everywhere. Once I worked 5 days straight for Covey Movers, the brother outfit they called themselves. For sobriety, that was my personal best that July. The guy in charge came up to me on the 5th day and asked me how I'd like to hire on full-time. "I can't," I said. The day labor contracts specifically forbid their guys from taking a steady job with any outside company for a month. "Ah, fuck that," he says. "Everyone winks at that bullshit. What do you say, Donnie? You're a good man, and I got an idea you could do a little more than buck furniture up on the truck. You want to think about it tonight?" I thought about it.
and thinking led back to drinking, as it always did that summer, as it always does for those of the alcoholic persuasion. Back to me sitting in some little bar across from the Empire State Building, listening to Elton John on the jukebox. Almost had your hooks in me, didn't you, dear? And when I went back to work, I checked in with a different day-labor company, one that had never heard of the fucking brother outfit. Callahan spat out the word fucking in a kind of desperate snarl, as men do when vulgarity has become for them a kind of linguistic court of last resort. You drank, you drifted, you worked, Roland said. But you had at least one other piece of business that summer, did you not? Yes. It took me a little while to get going. I saw several of them. The woman feeding the squirrels in the park was only the first, but they weren't doing anything. I mean, I knew what they were, but it was still hard to kill them in cold blood. Then one night in Battery Park, I saw another one feeding. I had a fold-out knife in my pocket by then, carried it everywhere. I walked up behind him while he was eating and stabbed him 4 times. Once in the kidneys, once between the ribs, once high up in the back, once in the neck. I put all my strength into the last one. The knife came out the other side with the thing's Adam's apple skewered on it like a piece of steak on a shish kebab. Made a kind of ripping sound. Callahan spoke matter-of-factly, but his face had grown very pale. What had happened in the alley behind home happened again. The guy disappeared right out of his clothes. I'd expected it, but of course I couldn't be sure until it actually happened. One swallow does not make a summer, Susanna said. Callahan nodded. The victim was this kid of about 15. Looked Puerto Rican or maybe Dominican. He had a boombox between his feet. I don't remember what it was playing, so it probably wasn't Someone Saved My Life Tonight. 5 minutes went by. I was about to start snapping my fingers under his nose or maybe patting his cheeks when he blinked, staggered, shook his head, and came around. He saw me standing there in front of him, and the first thing he did was grab his boombox. He held it to his chest like it was a baby. Then he said, "What'd you want, man?" I said I didn't want anything, not a single thing, no harm and no foul, but I was curious about those clothes lying beside him. The kid looked, then knelt down and started going through the pockets. I thought he'd find enough to keep him occupied, more than enough, and so I just walked away. And that was the second one. The third one was easier. The fourth one easier still. By the end of August, I'd gotten half a dozen. The sixth was the woman I'd seen in the Marine Midland Bank. Small world, isn't it? Quite often, I'd go down to 1st and 47th and stand across from home. Sometimes I'd find myself there in the late afternoon watching the drunks and the homeless people showing up for dinner. Sometimes Rowan would come out and talk to them. He didn't smoke, but he always kept cigarettes in his pockets. A couple of packs. And he'd pass them out until they were gone. I never made any particular effort to hide from him, but if he ever pegged me, I never saw any sign of it. You'd probably changed by then, Eddie said. Callahan nodded. Hair down to my shoulders, and coming in gray, a beard, and of course I no longer took any pains about my clothes. Half of what I was wearing by then came from the vampires I'd killed. One of them was a bicycle messenger guy, and he had a great pair of motorcycle boots, not bally loafers, but almost new and my size. Those things last forever. I've still got them, he nodded toward the house. But I don't think any of that was why he didn't recognize me. In Rowan Magruder's business, dealing with drunks and hypes and homeless people who've got one foot in reality and the other in the Twilight Zone, you get used to seeing big changes in people. And usually not changes for the better. You teach yourself to see who's under the new bruises and the fresh coats of dirt. I think it was more like I'd become one of what you call the vagrant dead, Roland. Invisible to the world. But I think those people, those former people, must be tied to New York.
They never go far, Roland agreed. His cigarette was done. The dry paper and crumbles of tobacco had disappeared up to his fingernails in 2 puffs. Ghosts always haunt the same house.
Of course they do, poor things. And I wanted to leave.
Every day the sun would set a little earlier, and every day I'd feel the call of those roads, those highways in hiding, a little more strongly. Some of it might have been the fabled geographic cure to which I believe I have already alluded. It's a wholly illogical but nonetheless powerful belief that things will change for the better in a new place, that the urge to self-destruct will magically disappear. Some of it was undoubtedly the hope that in another place, a wider place, there would be no more vampires or walking dead people to cope with, but mostly it was other things. Well, one very big thing. Callahan smiled, but it was no more than a stretch of the lips exposing the gums. Someone had begun hunting me. The vampires, Eddie said. Yes. Callahan bit at his lip, then repeated it with a little more conviction. Yes, but not just the vampires. Even when that had to be the most logical idea, it didn't seem entirely right. I knew it wasn't the dead, at least. They could see me, but didn't care about me one way or another, except maybe for the hope that I might be able to fix them or put them out of their misery. But the Type Threes couldn't see me, as I've told you, not as the thing hunting them anyway. And their attention spans are short, as if they're infected to some degree by the same amnesia they pass on to their victims. I first became aware that I was in trouble one night in Washington Square Park, not long after I killed the woman from the bank. That park had become a regular haunt of mine, although God knows I wasn't the only one. In the summer, it was a regular open-air dormitory. I even had my own favorite bench, although I didn't get it every night. Didn't even go there every night. On this particular evening, thundery and sultry and close, I got there around 8 o'clock. I had a bottle in a brown bag and a book of Ezra Pound's cantos. I approached the bench, and there, spray-painted across the back of another bench near mine, I saw a graffito that said, "He comes here. He has a burned hand." "Oh, my Lord God," Susanna said, and put a hand to her throat. I left the park at once and slept in an alley 20 blocks away. There was no doubt in my mind that I was the subject of that graffito. 2 nights later, I saw one on the sidewalk outside a bar on Lex, where I liked to drink and sometimes have a sandwich if I was, as they say, in funds. It had been done in chalk, and the foot traffic had rubbed it to a ghost, but I could still read it. It said the same thing. "He comes here. He has a burned hand." There were comets and stars around the message, as if whoever wrote it had actually tried to dress it up. A block down, spray-painted on a no-parking sign, "His hair is mostly white now." The next morning, on the side of a crosstown bus, "His name might be Collingwood." 2 or 3 days after that, I started to see lost pet posters around a lot of the places that had come to be my places. Needle Park, the Central Park west side of the Ramble, the City Lights bar on Lex, a couple of folk music and poetry clubs down in the village. "Pet posters," Eddie mused. "You know, in a way, that's brilliant." "They were all the same," Callahan said. "Have you seen our Irish setter? He is a stupid old thing, but we love him. Burned right forepaw. Answers to the name of Kelly, Collins, or Collingwood. We will pay a very large reward." And then a row of dollar signs. "Who would posters like that be aimed at?" Susanna asked. Callahan shrugged. "Don't know exactly. The vampires, perhaps." Eddie was rubbing his face wearily. "All right, let's see. We've got the Type 3 vampires, and the vagrant dead, and now this third group, the ones that went around putting up lost pet posters that weren't about pets and writing stuff on buildings and sidewalks. Who were they?" "The low men," Callahan said. "They call themselves that sometimes, although there are women among them. Sometimes they call themselves regulators. A lot of them wear long yellow coats, but not all. A lot of them have blue coffins tattooed on their hands, but not all." "Big coffin hunters, Roland," Eddie murmured. Roland nodded, but never took his eyes from Callahan. "Let the man talk, Eddie." "What they are, what they really are, is soldiers of the Crimson King," Callahan said, and he crossed himself.
12. Eddie started. Susanna's hand went back to her belly and began to rub. Roland found himself remembering their walk through Gage Park after they had finally escaped Blaine. The dead animals in the zoo, the run to Riot Rose Garden, the carousel and the toy train. Then the metal road leading up to the even larger metal road which Eddie, Susanna, and Jake called a turnpike. There, on one sign, someone had slashed, "Watch for the walkin' dude." And on another sign, decorated with the crude drawing of an eye, this message, "All hail the Crimson King."
"You've heard of the gentleman, I see," Callahan said, dryly. "Let's say he's left his mark where we could see it, too," Susanna said. Callahan nodded his head in the direction of Thunderclap. "If your quest takes you there," he said, "you're going to see a hell of a lot more than a few signs spray-painted on a few walls." "What about you?" Eddie asked. "What did you do?" "First, I sat down and considered the situation, and decided that no matter how fantastic or paranoid it might sound to an outsider, I really was being stalked, and not necessarily by Type 3 vampires. Although, of course, I did realize that the people leaving the graffiti around and putting up the lost pet posters wouldn't scruple to use the vampires against me. At this point, remember, I had no idea who this mysterious group could be. Back in Jerusalem's lot, Barlow moved into a house that had seen terrible violence and was reputed to be haunted. The writer Mears said that an evil house had drawn an evil man. My best thinking in New York took me back to that idea. I began to think I'd drawn another king vampire, another type one, the way the Marston house had drawn Barlow. Right idea or wrong one, it turned out to be wrong. I found it comforting to know my brain, booze-soaked or not, was still capable of some logic. The first thing I had to decide was whether to stay in New York or run away. I knew if I didn't run, they'd catch up to me, and probably sooner rather than later. They had a description, with this as an especially good marker. Callahan raised his burned hand. They almost had my name. Would have it for sure in another week or two. They'd stake out all my regular stops, places where my scent had collected. They'd find people I'd talked to, hung out with, played checkers and cribbage with. People I'd worked with on my manpower and brawny man jobs, too. This led me to a place I should have gotten to much sooner. Even after a month of binge drinking, I realized they'd find Rowan Magruder and home, and all sorts of other people who knew me there. Part-time workers, volunteers, dozens of clients, hell, after 9 months, hundreds of clients. On top of that, there was the lure of those roads. Callahan looked at Eddie and Susanna. "Do you know there's a footbridge over the Hudson River to New Jersey? It's practically in the shadow of the GWB, a plank footbridge that still has a few wooden drinking troughs for cows and horses along one side." Eddie laughed, the way a man will when he realizes one of his lower appendages is being shaken briskly. "Sorry, Father, but that's impossible. I've been over the George Washington Bridge maybe 500 times in my life. Henry and I used to go to Palisades Park all the time. There's no plank bridge." "There is, though," Callahan said calmly. "It goes back to the early 19th century, I should say, although it's been repaired quite a few times since then. In fact, there's a sign halfway across that says, 'Bicentennial Repairs Completed 1975 by Lemerck Industries.' I recalled that name the first time I saw Andy the Robot. According to the plate on his chest, that's the company that made him." "We've seen the name before, too," Eddie said, "in the City of Lud. Only there it said Lemerck Foundry." "Different divisions of the same company, probably," Susanna said. Roland said nothing, only made that impatient twirling gesture with the remaining two fingers of his right hand. "Hurry up, hurry up." "It's there, but it's hard to see," Callahan said. "It's in hiding. And it's only the first of the secret ways. From New York they radiate out like a spider's web." "Todash turnpikes," Eddie murmured. "Dig the concept." "I don't know if that's right or not," Callahan said. "I only know I saw extraordinary things in my wanderings over the next few years, and I also met a lot of good people. It seems almost an insult to call them normal people or ordinary people, but they were both. And certainly they give such words as normal and ordinary a feel of nobility for me."
I didn't want to leave New York without seeing Rowan Magruder again. I wanted him to know that maybe I had pissed in Lupe's dead face. I'd gotten drunk, surely enough, but I hadn't dropped my pants all the way down and done the other thing, which is my too clumsy way of saying I hadn't given up entirely, and that I'd decided not just to cower like a rabbit in a flashlight beam. Callahan had begun to weep again. He wiped at his eyes with the sleeves of his shirt. Also, I suppose I wanted to say goodbye to someone, and have someone say goodbye to me. The goodbyes we speak and the goodbyes we hear are the goodbyes that tell us we're still alive, after all. I wanted to give him a hug, and pass along the kiss Lupe had given me. Plus the same message. You're too valuable to lose. I... He saw Rosalita hurrying down the lawn with her skirt twitched up slightly at the ankle, and broke off. She handed him a flat piece of slate upon which something had been chalked. For a wild moment, Eddie imagined a message flanked by stars and moons, lost, one stray dog with mangled front paw, answers to the name of Roland, bad-tempered, prone to bite, but we love him anyway. "It's from Eisenhart," Callahan said, looking up. "If Overholzer's the big farmer in these parts, and Eben Took's the big businessman, then you'd have to call Vaughn Eisenhart the big rancher. He says that he, Sleitman Elder and Younger, and your Jake would meet us at Our Lady Falls noon, if it do you fine. It's hard to make out his shorthand, but I think he'd have you visit farms, small holds, and ranches on your way back out to the Rocking Bee, where you'd spend the night. Does it do you?"
"Not quite," Roland said. "I'd much like to have my map before I set off."
Callahan considered this, then looked at Rosalita. Eddie decided the woman was probably a lot more than just a housekeeper. She had withdrawn out of earshot, but not all the way back to the house. Like a good executive secretary, he thought. The old fella didn't need to beckon her. She came forward at his glance. They spoke, and then Rosalita set off. "I think we'll take our lunch on the church lawn," Callahan said. "There's a pleasant old ironwood there that'll shade us. By the time we're done, I'm sure the Tavery twins will have something for you."
Roland nodded, satisfied. Callahan stood up with a wince, put his hands in the small of his back and stretched.
"And I have something to show you now," he said. "You haven't finished your story," Susanna said. "No," Callahan agreed, "but time has grown short. I can walk and talk at the same time, if you fellas can walk and listen."
"We can do that," Roland said, getting up himself. There was pain, but not a great deal of it. Rosalita's cat oil was something to write home about. "Just tell me two things before we go."
"If I can, gunslinger, and do ye fine."
"They of the signs. Did you see them in your travels?"
Callahan nodded slowly. "Aye, gunslinger, so I did." He looked at Eddie and Susanna. "Have you ever seen a color photo of people, one taken with a flash, where everyone's eyes are red?"
"Yeah," Eddie said.
"Their eyes are like that. Crimson eyes. And your second question, Roland?"
"Are they the wolves' pair, these low men? These soldiers of the Crimson King, are they the wolves?"
Callahan hesitated a long time before replying. "I can't say for sure," he said at last. "Not 100%, can it? But I don't think so. Yet certainly they're kidnappers, although it's not just children they take." He thought over what he'd said. "Wolves of a kind, perhaps." He hesitated, thought it over some more, then said it again. "Aye, wolves of a kind."
Chapter 4. The Priest's Tale Continued. Highways in Hiding. 1. The walk from the backyard of the rectory to the front door of Our Lady of Serenity was a short one, taking no more than 5 minutes. That was surely not enough time for the old fella to tell them about the years he had spent on the bum before seeing a news story in the Sacramento Bee which had brought him back to New York in 1981, and yet the three gunslingers heard the entire tale nevertheless. Roland suspected that Eddie and Susanna knew what this meant as well as he did. When they moved on from Calla Bryn Sturgis, always assuming they didn't die here, there was every likelihood that Donald Callahan would be moving on with them. This was not just storytelling, but Kef, the sharing of water. And leaving the touch, which was a different matter, to one side, Kef could only be shared by those whom destiny had welded together for good or for ill. By those who were Ka-Tet. Callahan said, "You know how folks say we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto?" "The phrase has some vague resonance for us, Sugar." "Yes," Susanna said dryly. "Does it?" "Yes, I see just looking at you that it does. Perhaps you'll tell me your own story someday. I have an idea it would put mine to shame. In any case, I knew I wasn't in Kansas anymore as I approached the far end of the footbridge. And it seemed that I wasn't entering New Jersey either. At least, not the one I'd always expected to find on the other side of the Hudson. There was a newspaper crumpled against the..." 2. Footrail of the bridge, which seems completely deserted except for him, although vehicle traffic on the big suspension bridge to his left is heavy and constant, and Callahan bends to pick it up. The cool wind blowing along the river ruffles his shoulder-length salt and pepper hair. There's only one folded sheet, but the top of it's the front page of the Leebrook Register. Callahan has never heard of Leebrook. No reason he should have. He's no New Jersey scholar, hasn't even been over there since arriving in Manhattan the previous year, but he always thought the town on the other side of the GWB was Fort Lee. Then his mind is taken over by the headlines. The one across the top seems right enough. "Racial tensions in Miami ease," it reads. The New York papers have been full of these troubles over the last few days, but what to make of "War of Kites" continues in Teaneck, Hackensack, complete with a picture of a burning building. There's a photo of firemen arriving on a pumper, but they're all laughing. What to make of "President Agnew supports NASA terraform dream"? What to make of the item at the bottom, written in Cyrillic? "What has happened to me?" Callahan asks himself. All through the business of the vampires and the walking dead, even through the appearance of lost pet posters, which clearly refer to him, he has never questioned his sanity. Now, standing on the New Jersey end of this humble and most remarkable footbridge across the Hudson, this footbridge which is being utilized by no one except himself, he finally does. The idea of Spiro Agnew as president is enough all by itself, he thinks, to make anyone with a speck of political sense doubt his sanity. The man resigned in disgrace years ago, even before his boss did. "What has happened to me?" he wonders. But if he's a raving lunatic imagining all of this, he really doesn't want to know. "Bombs away," he says, and tosses the four-page remnant of the Leebrook Register over the railing of the bridge. The breeze catches it and carries it away toward the George Washington. That's reality, he thinks, right over there. Those cars, those trucks, those Peter Pan charter buses. But then, among them, he sees a red vehicle that appears to be speeding along on a number of circular treads. Above the vehicle's body, it's about as long as a medium-sized school bus, a crimson cylinder is turning. "Bandy," it says on one side, "Brooks," it says on the other. Bandy Brooks. Or Bandy Brooks. What the hell's Bandy Brooks? He has no idea. Nor has he ever seen such a vehicle in his life, and would not have believed such a thing, look at the treads for heaven's sake, would have been allowed on a public highway. So the George Washington Bridge isn't the safe world either. Or, not anymore. Callahan grabs the railing of the footbridge and squeezes down tightly as a wave of dizziness courses through him, making him feel unsteady on his feet and unsure of his balance. The railing feels real enough. Wood warmed by the sun and engraved with thousands of interlocking initials and messages. He sees DKLMB in a heart. He sees Freddie and Helena equals true love. He sees kill all SPIX and NIGERS. The message flanked by swastikas, and wonders at verbal depletion so complete the sufferer cannot even spell his favorite epithets. Messages of hate, messages of love, and all of them as real as the rapid beating of his heart or the weight of the few coins and bills in the right front pocket of his jeans. He takes a deep breath of the breeze, and that's real too, right down to the tang of diesel fuel. "This is happening to me. I know it is," he thinks. "I am not in some psychiatric hospital's Ward 9. I am me. I am here, and I'm even sober, at least for the time being. And New York is at my back. So is the town of Jerusalem's Lot, Maine, with its uneasy dead. Before me is the weight of America with all its possibilities." This thought lifts him, and is followed by one that lifts him even higher. Not just one America, perhaps, but a dozen, or a thousand, or a million. If that's Leebrook over there instead of Fort Lee, maybe there's another version of New Jersey where the town on the other side of the Hudson is Lehman or Layman or Lee Bluffs or Lee Palisades or Leghorn Village. Maybe instead of 42 continental United States on the other side of the Hudson, there are 4,200 or 42,000, all of them stacked in vertical geographies of chance. And he understands instinctively that this is almost certainly true. He has stumbled upon a great, possibly endless confluence of worlds. They are all America, but they are all different. There are highways which lead through them, and he can see them. He walks rapidly to the Leebrook end of the footbridge, then pauses again. "Suppose I can't find my way back," he thinks. "Suppose I get lost and wander and never find my way back to the America where Fort Lee is on the west side of the George Washington Bridge and Gerald Ford, of all people, is the President of the United States." And then he thinks, "So what if I do? So fucking what?" When he steps off on the Jersey side of the footbridge, he's grinning, truly lighthearted for this first time since the day he presided over Danny Glick's grave in the town of Jerusalem's Lot. A couple of boys with fishing poles are walking toward him. "Would one of you young fellows care to welcome me to New Jersey?" Callahan asks, grinning more widely than ever. "Welcome to NJ, man," one of them says, willingly enough, but both of them give Callahan a wide berth and a careful look. He doesn't blame them, but it doesn't cut into his splendid mood in the slightest. He feels like a man who has been let out of a gray and cheerless prison on a sunny day. He begins to walk faster, not turning around to give the skyline of Manhattan a single goodbye glance. Why would he? Manhattan is the past. The multiple Americas which lie ahead of him, those are the future. He is in Leebrook. There are no chimes. Later there will be chimes and vampires. Later there will be more messages chalked on sidewalks and sprayed on brick walls, not all about him either. Later, he will see the low men in their outrageous red Cadillacs and green Lincolns and purple Mercedes-Benz sedans, low men with red flash gun eyes, but not today. Today there is sunshine in a new America on the west side of a restored footbridge across the Hudson. On Main Street, he stops in front of the Leebrook Homestyle diner, and there's a sign in the window reading, "Short order cook wanted." Don Callahan short-ordered through most of his time at seminary and did more than his share of the same at home on the east side of Manhattan. He thinks he might fit right in here at the Leebrook home style. Turns out he's right, although it takes three shifts before the ability to crack a pair of eggs one-handed onto the grill comes swimming back to him. The owner, a long drink of water named Dickie Rudebaker, asks Callahan if he has any medical problems. "Catching stuff," he calls it, and nods simple acceptance when Callahan says he doesn't. He doesn't ask Callahan for any paperwork, not so much as a social security number. He wants to pay his new short order off the books, if that's not a problem. Callahan assures him it is not. "One more thing," says Dickie Rudebaker, and Callahan waits for the shoe to drop. Nothing would surprise him, but all Rudebaker says is, "You look like a drinking man." Callahan allows, as how he has been known, to take a drink. "So have I," Rudebaker says. "In this business, it's the way you protect your goddamn sanity. I ain't gonna smell your breath when you come in, if you come in on time. Miss coming in on time twice, though, and you're on your way to wherever. I ain't gonna tell you that again." Callahan short orders at the Leebrook Homestyle Diner for 3 weeks and stays two blocks down at the Sunset Motel. Only it's not always the Homestyle, and it's not always the Sunset. On his fourth day in town, he wakes up in the Sunrise Motel, and the Leebrook Homestyle Diner is the Fort Lee Homestyle Diner. The Leebrook Register, which people have been leaving behind on the counter, becomes the Fort Lee Register American. He is not exactly relieved to discover Gerald Ford has reassumed the presidency. When Rutabaker